It turns out that we're all taking different paths in pursuit of the same goal, happiness. In 2007, I started getting interested in learning more about the science of happiness. I learned that it was a relatively new research field known as positive psychology. Prior to 1998, almost all psychology was about trying to figure out how to get people who had something wrong with them more normal. But most psychologists and researchers never bothered to examine what would make normal people happier. I started reading more and more books and articles about the science of happiness, including Happiness Hypothesis and Happier. Initially, it was just a side hobby and interest of mine that had nothing to do with Zappos. And then one day, it hit me. It had everything to do with Zappos. In retrospect, it seems so obvious, but it took me over a year to figure this out. We've always had customers tell us that they think of the experience of opening up a Zappos shipment as happiness in a box. Whether it's the happiness that customers feel when they receive the perfect pair of shoes or the perfect outfit, or the happiness that customers feel from our surprise upgrades to overnight shipping, or when they talk to someone on our customer loyalty team, or the happiness that employees feel from being part of a culture whose values match their own personal values. The thing that ties all of these things together is happiness. In 2009, we expanded our vision and purpose to a simple statement. Zappos is about delivering happiness to the world. It's been interesting to look at the evolution of the Zappos brand promise over the years. 1999, larger selection of shoes. 2003, customer service. 2005, culture and core values as our platform. 2007, personal emotional connection. 2009, delivering happiness. From my perspective, it seemed to make sense to try to learn more about the science of happiness so that the knowledge could be applied to running our business. We could learn about some of the science behind how to make customers and employees happier. Today, we even offer a science of happiness class to our employees. As I studied the field more, I learned that one of the consistent findings from the research was that people are very bad at predicting what will actually bring them sustained happiness. Most people go through their lives thinking, when I get X, then I'll be happy. Or, when I achieve X, then I'll be happy. In fact, the research shows that the happiness they thought they would achieve fades fairly quickly. For example, there have been studies on lottery winners that compare their happiness levels right before winning the lottery with their happiness levels a year later. The studies generally find that a person's happiness level reverts back to wherever it was before. To me, learning about this phenomenon was incredibly interesting. It meant that, for most people, finally achieving their goal in life, whatever it was, whether it was making money, getting married, or running faster, would not actually bring them sustained happiness. And yet, many people have spent their entire lives pursuing what they thought would make them happy. So the question for you to ask yourself is whether what you think you want to pursue will actually get you the happiness you think it will get you. If the ultimate goal is happiness, then wouldn't it make sense for you to study and learn more about the science of happiness so that you can apply the research that's already been done to your own life? With just a little bit of knowledge based on the findings from scientific research, how much happier could you be? How much happier could your customers and employees be if you applied the knowledge to your company? How much healthier would your business be as a result? I ran my first marathon in 2006. Prior to that, I had never run more than a mile in my life. Like summiting Kilimanjaro, it was something I just wanted to check off of my list of things to do. I didn't know anything about how to train for a marathon, so I started reading articles and books about it. As it turned out, there had been plenty of research done about the science of running and training for a marathon. I had initially assumed that I would have to run really hard for several months every day in order to achieve the best results in the marathon, but that turned out not to be the case at all. In fact, the research has shown that the best way to train for a marathon is to do long runs at a slower pace than you would actually run the marathon at. A rule of thumb is to run slow enough so that you can comfortably carry on a long conversation without being out of breath. When I tried to do that the first time, it felt almost uncomfortably slow. This training strategy is now accepted as common knowledge amongst marathon runners, but for the rest of us, it can seem pretty counterintuitive. Just like we instinctually know how to run, we instinctually think we know what will make us happy. But research has shown that you can perform better in a marathon if you train yourself in ways that may initially seem to go against your gut instinct. Similarly, research in the science of happiness has shown that there are things that can make you happier that you may not realize will actually make you happier. And the reverse is true as well. There are things that you think will make you happy, but actually won't in the long run. I don't claim to be an expert in the field of the science of happiness. I've just been reading books and articles about it because I find the topic really interesting. So I wanted to briefly share some of the frameworks of happiness that I personally found the most useful in helping shape my thinking, with the goal of whetting your appetite to do a little bit of reading yourself so that you can maximize your own personal level of happiness. Happiness framework number one. Happiness is really just about four things. Perceived control, perceived progress, connectedness, meaning the number and depth of your relationships, and vision or meaning, being part of something bigger than yourself. What's interesting about this framework is that you can apply these concepts to your business as well. Perceived control. In our call center, we used to give raises once a year to our reps, which they didn't really have any control over. We later decided to implement a skill set system instead. We have about 20 different skill sets that are analogous to merit badges in the Boy Scouts, with a small bump in pay associated with each of the skill sets. It's up to each individual rep to decide whether to get trained and certified on each of the skill sets. If someone chooses not to get any, then he or she simply stays at the same pay level. If someone is ambitious and wants to gain all 20 skill sets, then we let the rep decide on the right pace to achieve that. We've since found that our call center reps are much happier being in control of their pay and which skill sets to attain. Perceived progress. In our merchandising department at Zappos, we used to promote employees from the entry-level position of merchandising assistant to the next level of assistant buyer after 18 months, assuming they met all the requirements to qualify for the promotion. We later decided to give smaller promotions every 6 months instead, that together were the equivalent of the previous single promotion. After 18 months, consisting of 3 6-month periods of smaller promotions, the end result was still the same in terms of training, certification, and pay as the previous promotion schedule. We found that employees are much happier because there's an ongoing sense of perceived progress. Connectedness. Studies have shown that engaged employees are more productive, and that the number of good friends an employee has at work is correlated with how engaged that employee is. In The Happiness Hypothesis, the author concludes that happiness doesn't come primarily from within, but rather from between. This is one of the reasons why we place so much emphasis on company culture at Zappos. Vision or meaning. Both Good to Great and Tribal Leadership discuss how a company with a vision that has a higher purpose beyond just money, profits, or being number one in a market is an important element of what separates a great company in terms of long-term financial performance from a good one. Happiness framework number two. Chip Conley's book, Peak, does an excellent job of describing how Maslow's hierarchy can be condensed to a pyramid of three levels for business purposes and applied to customers, employees, and investors. The fundamental premise behind Maslow's hierarchy of human needs is that once a person's survival needs are met, food, safety, shelter, water, etc., then humans are more motivated by other non-materialistic needs such as social status, achievement, and creativity. Chip Conley describes the three levels of the customer pyramid as meets expectations, meets desires, and meets unrecognized needs. He describes the three levels of the employee pyramid as money, recognition, and meaning. And he describes the three levels of the investor pyramid as transaction alignment, relationship alignment, and legacy. Many companies and managers believe that giving employees more money will make them happier, whereas most HR surveys show that once people's basic needs are met, money is farther down the list of importance than intangibles such as the quality of the relationship with one's manager and professional growth opportunities. At Zappos, an example of the customer hierarchy at work would be receives correct item, meets expectations, free shipping, meets desires, surprise upgrade to overnight shipping, meets unrecognized needs. Happiness framework number three. three types of happiness: pleasure, passion, and higher purpose. Pleasure. The pleasure type of happiness is about always chasing the next high. I like to refer to it as the rock star type of happiness because it's great if you have a constant inflow of stimuli, but it's very hard to maintain unless you're living the lifestyle of a rock star. Research has shown that of the three types of happiness, this is the shortest lasting. As soon as the source of stimuli goes away, people's happiness levels drop immediately. Passion. The passion type of happiness is also known as flow, where peak performance meets peak engagement, and time flies by. Research has shown that of the three types of happiness, this is the second longest lasting. Professional athletes sometimes refer to this state as being in the zone. Higher purpose. The higher purpose type of happiness is about being part of something bigger than yourself that has meaning to you. Research has shown that of the three types of happiness, this is the longest lasting. What I find interesting is that many people go through life chasing after the pleasure type of happiness, thinking that once they are able to sustain that, then they will worry about the passion and, if they get around to it, look for their higher purpose. Based on the findings of the research, however, the proper strategy would be to figure out and pursue the higher purpose first, since it's the longest lasting type of happiness, then layer on top of that the passion, and then add on top of that the pleasure type of happiness. Happiness as a fractal. According to Merriam-Webster, a fractal is any irregular curves or shapes for which any chosen part is similar in shape to a given larger or smaller part when magnified or reduced to the same size. One of the properties of fractals is that if you zoom in or zoom out, the picture looks the same or very similar. According to Wikipedia, many natural objects have fractal-like properties, including clouds, mountain ranges, lightning bolts, coastlines, snowflakes, various vegetables such as cauliflower and broccoli, and animal coloration patterns. I think the parallels between what the research has found makes people happy, pleasure, passion, and purpose, and what the research has found makes for great long-term companies, profits, passion, and purpose, makes for one of the most interesting fractals I've ever come across. At first glance, the patterns generated by geometric fractals may seem infinitely complex, but it's often just a simple mathematical formula that generates them. Similarly, setting out to create a great long-term company may seem to be an overwhelmingly daunting task at first, but using happiness as an organizing principle can help guide you along the way. Even though writing a book was one of the things I wanted to check off of my list of things to do, this book wasn't written just for that reason. And even though this will serve as a handbook for future Zappos employees, and maybe get us a few additional customers as well, this wasn't written for the benefit of Zappos either. I wanted to write this book for a different reason: to contribute to a happiness movement to help make the world a better place. My hope is that, through this book, established businesses will look to change the way they're doing things, and entrepreneurs will be inspired to start new companies with happiness at the core of their business models, taking with them some of the lessons I've learned personally, as well as the lessons we've collectively learned at Zappos. My hope is that more and more companies will start to apply some of the findings coming out of the research in the field of the science of happiness to make their business better and their customers and employees happier. My hope is this will not only bring you happiness, but also enable you to bring other people more happiness. If happiness is everyone's ultimate goal, wouldn't it be great if we could change the world and get everyone in every business thinking in that context and that framework? I don't have all the answers, but hopefully I've succeeded in getting you to start asking yourself the right questions. Are you working towards maximizing your happiness each day? What is the net effect of your existence on the total amount of happiness in the world each day? What are your values? What are you passionate about? What inspires you? What is your goal in life? What are your company's values? What is your company's higher purpose? What is your higher purpose? Bertice Barry said, "When you walk with purpose, you collide with destiny." I hope listening to this audiobook has inspired you to make your customers happier through better customer service, or make your employees happier by focusing more on company culture, or make yourself happier by learning more about the science of happiness. If this book has inspired you, then I'll have done my part in helping both Zappos and myself achieve our higher purpose, delivering happiness to the world. Epilogue. Join the movement. As a guiding principle in life for anything I do, I try to ask myself, what would happen if everyone in the world acted in the same way? What would the world look like? What would the net effect be on the overall happiness in the world? This thought experiment has been useful to me when thinking about whether to share how we do things at Zappos, or whether to get upset at the waitress who accidentally got my order wrong, or whether to hold the door open for a stranger who is a slightly inconvenient distance away. The same questions are just as important for deciding what not to do, even if not doing anything is the default choice. The ideas could end here. You can choose to turn off the audiobook and do nothing and move on with the rest of your life. Or you can be part of a movement to help make the world a happier and better place. The choice is yours. Visit us online at www.deliveringhappinessbook.com. Learn what else you can do to be a part of the movement. Together, we can change the world. Buddha once said, "Thousands of candles can be lit from a single candle, and the life of the candle will not be shortened." Happiness never decreases by being shared.
Tweets to live by. Life isn't about finding yourself. Life is about creating yourself. George Bernard Shaw. It is amazing what you can accomplish if you do not care who gets the credit. Harry S. Truman. We either make ourselves miserable or we make ourselves strong. The amount of work is the same. Carlos Castaneda. What lies behind us and what lies before us are tiny matters compared to what lies within us. Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Now, a special conversation between Tony Hsieh and Dr. Warren Bennis, recorded at University of Southern California Marshall School of Business. Introduction by Dave Logan.
Starting with Dr. Bennis, if you go online and read one of his many bios, you'll hear things like the fact that he's named by Forbes magazine as Dean of the Leadership Gurus, and that his books have been nominated for various prizes and have done all sorts of good things. And that's all true. And it's about like saying Abraham Lincoln was tall and had a beard. Okay. So here's the truth about Dr. Bennis. It's been said that you can tell the difference between an expert and a master if you ask them a question. And the expert will tell you the answer. And then you go away and you feel smarter because you know the answer. And the master will say, "That's a really interesting question. Why don't you sit down and we'll talk about it?" Which is why you often see Dr. Bennis sitting down with various people talking about some interesting things. And typical of how masters like to conduct sessions, you'll notice that we have a couple of chairs here so that we get to sit down and learn together. I would say that if you can get inside the way that Dr. Bennis sees the world even a little bit, then the session will pay dividends that will go on for many, many years. I've had the opportunity to write books that have been on bestseller lists and things of that nature, and I will tell you that 100% of the inspiration has come from Dr. Bennis, and he probably doesn't know that, but it's true. I'm here because he's at USC, and I have written the books because he's inspired them. And I say that not, again, to in any way highlight myself, but there are thousands of people around the world that would say exactly the same thing, people far more influential or successful than I will ever be. It's said of leaders that leaders promote and support other leaders, who in turn support and promote other leaders. And by that definition, you won't find a greater leader in the world than Warren. because he promotes the people and supports the people who support the people who support the people who support the people who actually do leadership. I had the opportunity to meet our second guest, Tony Hsieh, a couple of years ago. I got an email from him in his characteristic lowercase style that he's famous for on email, saying, "Hi, Dave, you don't know me. My name is Tony Hsieh. I run a company called Zappos." I had heard of neither Tony Hsieh nor Zappos, which I'm embarrassed to say. And I was talking to my wife about the fact that I get emails from time to time, and she said, "Well, like who?" And I mentioned those two names, and after she called me an idiot for a couple of minutes, she said, "You have no idea how special that company was." And so I got to know Tony, went out to Las Vegas. If you ever have the opportunity to go see Zappos, it is like going to the Mecca of organizational culture. In other words, we can have intellectual discussions about it, but until you see it, until you experience it, then you don't really understand what organizational culture can be. The thing about Tony is he exemplifies, he is the walking embodiment of the values of Zappos. So in a sense, you don't need to go to Zappos, although very much hope you all do. It will blow your minds in a very good way. But Tony is the walking embodiment of the values of his company, things like humility. He's been called quirky. One of the values of Zappos is be a little bit weird, okay? And Tony exemplifies that with pride. Most of all, service. I was in a meeting with Tony not too long ago, and I looked to where he had been sitting and realized he wasn't sitting there anymore because he was refilling someone's water glass. Service is the most important value of Zappos, and again, he exemplifies it. So what we have the opportunity to do here today is to hear a conversation between literally two of the most interesting people in the world when it comes to leadership, advances in organizational culture, and doing things that leave the rest of the world really scratching their heads, wondering, how did they do that? So, ladies and gentlemen, please help me in welcoming Dr. Warren Bennis and Mr. Tony Hsieh.
David, thank you for that marvelous introduction to Tony and me. This really isn't as bad as it looks, incidentally. It was once said about the music of Wagner that it was Mark Twain actually said about the music of Wagner, "It ain't nearly as bad as it sounds." Well, this is sort of the way I feel, but had I been wearing a pair of Zappos shoes, I never would have made the terrible fall I made 4 weeks ago. And it's going to take me a little while to get over a bunch of broken bones and all that stuff, but it'll get better. And I'm just so pleased to be here with Tony Hsieh. We talked a little bit about what we might do this morning. Mm-hmm. And I prepared a couple of questions before in which he's not seen. And he's prepared a couple of questions, I think, which I know I've not seen. And we thought what we would do is exchange questions. I have three or four, and Tony may have a certain number. And then we're going to open it up for you to ask questions of us, if that's a way of proceeding, which I hope is agreeable for you all. So let me start in with a couple of these questions that I should have here for Tony. So I put them on 3x5 cards. Well, I'll read it aloud, okay? And I'm going to start with a two-part question. At dinner the other night, this last Thursday night, a woman, the hostess, turned and asked me a question that I've never been asked before. And as David was pointing out earlier, I think the questions we ask are almost more important than the answers we sometimes get. I've often wanted to teach a course on what is a good question. So I think the idea of just exchanging these. So this is a two-part. Part of the other night at the dinner party, the hostess turned to me and said, "At what time in your life have you been the happiest?" I thought, well, that's really an interesting question, I thought. At what point in your life, what time in your life have you been the happiest? And then, Tony, this is the second, it's related. In your March 09 speech that I saw the transparencies for, it was entitled Delivering Happiness. Very interesting. So what I'm going to ask you is, how do you define happiness, and why do you think it is so important?
It's hard to answer the first one, where it's, there's a couple ways I think about happiness. One is, if there's specific moments, there's definitely moments that just stick with me, and I'm sure with everyone. So I actually have a book by the same name that's coming out called Deliving Happiness. It comes out in June, and we actually, I think, have advanced copies for everyone here in the audience. Basically, the book starts out with talking about...
Actually, that's the name of the book, Delivering Happiness.
Yes. And the book actually starts out with... So for those... how many of you have heard of Zappos before? And okay, and how many of you have actually shopped with Zappos before? Oh, very cool. For those who may not have heard, Zappos was acquired by Amazon last November, but it was announced in July of last year, and we announced it to the company, and then 2 days later, we held an all-hands meeting in Las Vegas, where our headquarters were. We had about 700 or 800 employees in a room, and basically went over, spent an hour going over everything in terms of we were still going to remain independent and still continue building the Zappos brand and culture the way we always have. It was going to be very different from other acquisitions that Amazon had done. And then at the end, we surprised our employees by announcing that we were, Alfred and I, Alfred's the CFO and COO, were buying everyone a Kindle. And then we also announced as a surprise that, so in previous all-hands meetings, we had surprised them with giving everyone a one-time bonus of 10% of whatever they had earned in the previous year. And with the Amazon acquisition, one of the things that we were able to do was, normally in acquisition scenarios, they have big, they call them retention bonuses or something that's normally restricted to the top, say, 10 or 15 people in the company. And we wanted to instead spread it around to all the employees. So we announced that we were going to give them actually 40% of whatever they had earned in the previous 12 months. And so, like, that moment when they heard that number, it was spontaneous. Like, the entire room just stood up and cheered, and people were crying. And there were some people that now they could take their kid to Disneyland, which they couldn't afford to do before. And there were other people where they were wondering how they were going to get a medical procedure, and now this enabled that. And so it was just, you know, that one moment, it wasn't about the money. It was everyone, like, standing up and cheering and crying and, you know, doing that simultaneously. Like, that was one of the happiest moments for not just me, but for everyone. And we were all, you know, experiencing that together. And so that was pretty special. And then, how do you define happiness, and why do you think it's so important? One question I like to ask people is, and I would ask you guys to think about, like, what is your goal in life? You know, if you ask different people that question, you'll get different answers. Some people will say they want to grow a business. Other people say they want to find a boyfriend or girlfriend. Or other people say they want to run a marathon. If you think about what your actual answer is, and then the next question is, why? And then people will have different answers, like, so I can find a soulmate, or so I can be healthier, or so I can make more money. And then you ask why again, and then people will come up with different answers. But what's interesting is, if you ask why, ask yourself why enough times, and ask other people why enough times, eventually everyone comes to the same answer, and it's that they believe that whatever their goal in life is will ultimately bring them happiness. And so, you know, we're all connected in terms of, we're ultimately all just seeking happiness. And so, you know, there's been a lot of research, especially over the past 12 years or so. There's this whole field called positive psychology that's really just about the science of happiness. I'm not talking about going to the self-help section and just think positive and be happy. It's like actual research that has been done. And, you know, one of the things that has come out of the research is that people are actually very bad at predicting what will make them happy, bring them happiness in the long term. And, you know, there's been studies of lottery winners, for example, where you look at their happiness right before winning the lottery, and then you look at their happiness a year later, and a year later it's the same, or, you know, even lower than it was before. And yet, I ask everyone here, if you would like to win the lottery tomorrow, and do you think that would make you happier? Probably everyone would say yes. So I thought that was interesting. And originally I was just reading, this was a couple of years ago, I was just reading it, studying it just as a hobby, and then kind of realized that actually there's a lot of stuff that's come out of the research that's already been done that you can apply to business in terms of making customers happy, in terms of making employees happy. For example, one framework that I talk about in the book is that happiness is about just four things: perceived control, perceived progress, connectedness, meaning the number and depth of your relationships, and then being part of something bigger than yourself that is meaningful to you. Some of the stuff we kind of stumbled on at Zappos, and then other stuff because of the frameworks that has come out of the research that's been done, can actually be more purposeful about applying it to business. So, for example, in terms of perceived progress, we used to hire people in our merchandising department, entry level, give them all the training and so on, and then they would get a promotion 18 months later, and then they get trained and certified and so on, and then get another promotion 18 months later. And so over a three-year period, they go from entry level to becoming a full-fledged buyer at Zappos, which is kind of a big thing within our company. Well, we changed it a couple years ago so that instead of a promotion every 18 months, we gave smaller promotions every 6 months. And they still went through the exact same process and, you know, still had to get certified and so on. It still took 3 years to become a buyer, but we found that employees were much happier because they had the sense of ongoing progress every 6 months instead of waiting 18 months. I think it's just really interesting how you can take the stuff that's come out of the research and apply it to business.
I think you also said in your book, or one of the articles about you, is that happiness is also contagious. I think it is in some curious way. But it's a tough concept to get your arms around them. But I agree with Tony, there's a growing field with now even being called by some of the happiness industry. And in a way, it's a nice counterbalance to a society where we've been so, at least clinically speaking, psychologically speaking, so connected with the idea of pathologizing everything. It's a very hard thing to define. In the trade, it's called subjective well-being. You know, that's the usual term used for general happiness. And it's an interesting field, and I think what could be more appropriate to a service business than that? You are delivering happiness to your clients, to your customers.
So what's interesting is that that's how we initially started. We were really focused on trying to deliver the best customer service and customer experience to make customers happier. And then trying to create a culture that so that employees still want to be around 10 years down the road. That's about making employees happier. And then going back to the fourth, I talk about perceived control, perceived progress, connectedness, and being part of something bigger than yourself. That not only applies to individuals, but it applies to companies as well. And Dave Logan's book, Tribal Leadership, we actually have classes at Zappos where we teach his book and go over his book. And so, you know, his framework is about there being five levels of companies or company culture or people. So his level four is about companies where it's the entire company is unified in a team. It's like, we're unified, we're all aligned, and we're better than the competition. But then his examples of level five behavior is, it's not about killing the competition. His example is Amgen is, when asked who your competition is, it's not naming some other drug company. It's, our competition is cancer. For us, you know, part of the purpose of the book and what we try to do at Zappos as, and this has kind of evolved over the past few years, is it's not just about making our employees happy or making our customers happy, but sharing with the world the mistakes we've made and the lessons we've learned and to help make other companies have stronger cultures and make their own customers happier.
One thing I was curious about in your background, Tony, was the first company you started, which you ended up selling to Microsoft, as I recall, back in 1998,
yep.
Something like that. And I was surprised there because you said you started off with a very small group of 5 to 10 people, and then when you got to 100 people, as I recall, you then felt that the company culture had lost its way. And what I was wondering about is, this is the Starbucks story too. Came out a couple of years ago, a leaked memo that he had written. that we're not the Starbucks that we used to be. We're not somebody I know for years now. We met each other before as friends, not having anything to do with his business. But he stayed around to revive that company. You sold yours. I'm not making any judgment about that decision, but I was curious as why didn't you start thinking about reviving the culture that you started with rather than selling it? Do you think it was hopeless or what? Or was it an irresistible price?
It was probably a combination. We actually hired an outside CEO and at the previous company, Link Exchange. Well, and just to give some background, because basically in 1996, with the college roommates, started a company called Link Exchange, and we grew that to about 100 or so people. And then 2.5 years later, sold it to Microsoft. But what most people don't know was really the primary motivation for selling the company was just because it just wasn't a fun place to work at anymore. And the culture just went completely downhill because we just didn't know any better to pay attention to it. I remember when it was just 5 or 10 of us, it was a lot of fun. It was kind of like your typical dot-com back at the time. We were, you know, working around the clock, had no idea what day of the week it was, sleeping under our desks, showering occasionally, and we hired all the people with the right skill sets and experiences, but not all of them were culture fits, and it's not that any one hire brought the company culture downhill. Just slowly over time, it just degraded. We didn't know any better to try to actively manage the culture. And so I just remember one day I just kept hitting the snooze button over and over again because I dreaded going into the office. And that was kind of a weird feeling because this was a company I co-founded. And if I myself didn't want to go into the office, then wondered how all the other employees felt. I also wasn't in control of the company anymore because we had hired an outside CEO.
And oh, I see.
So, and I wasn't, you know, the sole shareholder of the company either. Yeah. So it was just easier to sell the company and then start something new at that point.
Do you have a question for me?
What's been the most surprising thing that you've learned over, say, the past however long you've been in the guru business?
It's funny you ask that question because, well, I'm going to push Tony's book. Again, Delivering Happiness. It's coming out when?
June 7th.
Yeah. I've read parts of it, not the whole book. It is really neat and writes very well and I think an important book. I think it's going to do well. I charge for blurbs these days, but I'd be willing to say, give you one free. So it's a marvelous book. Congratulations. I think it's going to make a difference. And the reason I'm bringing your book up is to push my own. And it's my, I don't know, I don't think it's going to be my last book, but it's going to be my 30th book. And it's a memoir, which is a kind of a very difficult thing to do because it's very delicate because on the one hand, you've got to avoid two things. One is you've got to avoid your kind of a grandiosity. How terrific I've been and all that. You've got to also avoid the equal difficulty of false modesty. One of our former presidents, Teddy Roosevelt, in his autobiography wrote, "The bravest man I ever met in the world was the sergeant who followed me up the hill at San Juan." Well, is that subtle when you think about that? You know? So you've got to avoid both those things. Why I'm intrigued with that question of yours, the title of the book, this memoir, which is coming out later in the year, it's called Still Surprised.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's why your question is so fascinating. And so I'm, the beauty of being in university, the beauty of not just being in university, but of life for people, it's related to one of the things that you write about in your core values, but humility. The beauty of my life is continually being surprised about the world, about what's going on, about almost everyday occurrences. And I guess if I were to think about, as I review the things I've done in my life, Tony, and I've been so blessed, it's so funny because we come from, you and I, from two opposite, totally opposite backgrounds. You were born here with Taiwanese parents. I don't know about your parents, but I was born in Bronx of working class parents. And yet, when I read your work, I'm amazed at how much aligned it is with, and I must also say surprised, though we come from such different cultures, how we've ended up pretty much in the same place in terms of ideas, not in terms of income. I want to make that clear. Although, I might as well get it in now before the morning goes on too long. I don't get a fee for that. You know, I used to speak for fees only. Usually I get something of a fee. So I have gone on the internet a couple of nights ago, and I sent you two books, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And this is, you're going to be my, it's not a fee exactly, but this is what's called an exchange. For those two books, I've ordered a model shoe I want.
Okay.
And I've written it all out. It's model 993, New Balance. I've got very wide feet, so it's the number, the order number is SKU, number 7465965. And it's, they're not that cheap, by the way. But it's my favorite shoe. And
this is, so you have not actually ordered it? Or
what?
You have ordered, I wasn't clear if you had actually ordered it or you would like
to. Oh, no, I haven't. I thought I would order it directly with
okay.
the order.
Well,
my home address, all the details are there.
Okay.
10½, 4E.
Oh, that really is your
New Balance,
address.
Yeah.
All right, I'll make sure.
If I had worn those shoes the other day, I would not have been tripped on some dumb rug in nearby.
Well, so, it seems like a fair trade. Like, I'll get you something for your feet, and you get
and the next time
for
I see
hands.
You, the price of the books go up because I'm going to actually personally. No, they're signed. So.
No, they're going for a lot on eBay.
So about sir, so about surprise. I guess, yeah. I'll tell you one thing that comes quickly to my mind is the surprise of the potentiality of growth. Because I know that though you don't use these specific words, and I want to get back to my next question about culture. I've been teaching this course jointly with soon to be succeeded President Steve Sample, who's been over almost 20 years a great, great university president. You went to a school called Harvard, which hasn't had such good success with their presidents in recent years. But never mind that. I don't want to get into that. I'm amazed at the potential for growth. Surprised that this is an honors program we teach. We have like 300 students applying. We take 40. And every year I'm impressed with how much the richness of the life of learning. The beauty and the surprise of my life is I get paid for the pleasure of finding things out. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, you know, in a way, we're in the same business. I mean, I don't consider myself an entrepreneur. I admire enormously entrepreneurs, by the way. And I'm so glad that USC has been one of the leaders. In fact, to my knowledge, it's the first university that really put an emphasis on an entrepreneurial thing. So I guess it's my continual surprise at the potentialities for growth and change and learning and of seeing this occur almost before your eyes like time-lapse photography in the course of a semester, which is saying a lot. You get more of a sense of another thing that you emphasize very much is self-awareness. It's how much self-awareness and growth and learning comes through that. So can I get to my next question to you? This is from a PowerPoint presentation you gave last year, and it's Zappos Core Values. One of the things about Tony's book and about his firm is the whole emphasis on core values. And I want you to talk a little bit about how you developed those. Well, there are 10 of them. How do you build and sustain and keep revivifying, or keep passion and the happiness. So it's building and sustaining. How does it lead you to do that? When you sold Inc. Exchange to Microsoft, I mentioned this earlier, because the culture worsened. Those are your words. I said, why did you try to revive it? I think of Howard Schultz's, I'm closer to that experience because he really felt they lost their way. How does, there were 120,000 employees. How many employees do you have? 1,600?
Roughly 1,600.
Yeah. How do you build those values at Zappos, and how do you sustain them? It's a critical issue because I agree totally with you that the culture that one works in is that culture of the great happiness and love for the work, right? And the 10 values, you may or may not want to refer to them, but here, this is your PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. But tell about building a culture, because and a culture of growth and learning and happiness.
I think this was a story about Starbucks that I heard back a few years ago where this may be, I don't know if this is legend or if it's actually true, but I heard someone ask Howard Schultz, how do you get all your employees to smile all the time? This was back in the early days, and his response was, I just hire people that smile. It's a lot easier than trying to train someone to smile. And so, we have the same philosophy at Zappos. You know, a lot of companies have things called, they might call them core values or guiding principles or whatever, but I think the problem with most companies that have them is they're usually kind of very lofty sounding. They read like they were written by the PR department, and you know, maybe you learn about it on day one of orientation, but then it just becomes this meaningless plaque on the lobby wall. And so for us, we actually do two separate sets of interviews when we hire employees. The first set is by the hiring manager and his or her team, and it's kind of the standard, looking for fit within the team, relevant experience, technical ability, and so on. But then our HR department does a separate set of interviews purely for culture fit, for core values, and they have to pass both in order to be hired. We've passed on a lot of really smart, talented people that we know can make an immediate impact on our top or bottom line, but if they're not a culture fit, then we won't hire them. So you mentioned we have 10 core values. We actually have interview questions for each and every one of those core values. So one of our core values is create fun and a little weirdness. And one of our interview questions is literally on a scale 1 to 10, how weird are you? And
By the way, that's another question. Is that coming up for you?
Okay.
Go on with that.
If you're a 1, you're probably a little bit too straight-laced for Zappos. If you're a 10, you might be a little bit too psychotic for us. But it's actually not the number that matters so much as it is just seeing how candidates respond, because some of them are trying to fish for the right answer, and they're like, well, what's your answer? And then they try to come up with the right thing. It's for us, our belief is that everyone's a little weird somehow, and it's really just more a fun way of saying that we really recognize and celebrate each person's individuality, and we want their true personalities to come out in the workplace environment, whether it's dealing with each other as coworkers or with customers over the phone. Our phone calls are not scripted. We really leave it up to each rep to interact in a way that fits their personality to form a personal emotional connection with each customer, one phone call at a time, and that's how we build our brand. Another one of our core values is to be creative, adventurous, and open-minded. And so one of our interview questions is, on a scale 1 to 10, how lucky are you in life? And 1 is, I don't know why bad things always seem to happen to me. 10 is, I don't know why good things always seem to happen to me. We try not to hire the ones because they're bad luck and we don't want bad luck to come to Zappos. But this was actually inspired by a research study I'd read about several years ago where they actually asked that question to a bunch of random people and got answers all over the board, some ones, some tens, a lot in between. And then afterwards they had them do a task. And the task was to go through a newspaper and count the number of photos that were in that newspaper. But what the participants didn't know was that it was actually a fake newspaper. And sprinkled throughout the newspaper were these headlines that would say things like, if you're reading this headline, you can stop. The answer is 37 plus collect an extra $100 when you tell the researcher this. And what they found was that the people that consider themselves unlucky in life generally never noticed the headlines. They just went through the task at hand and eventually came up with the right answer. And the people that consider themselves lucky in life generally saw the headline, stopped early, made an extra $100. So the takeaway is that it's not that people are inherently lucky or unlucky, but luck is really more about being open to the opportunity beyond just how the task or situation presents itself. Yeah. And so that's why we ask that question for our core value number four.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing question. And Napoleon, by the way, when he was thinking about appointing an officer into high general position, would always ask them to feel they were lucky. When you get over the modesty thing, when people say, yeah, I've just been lucky, but when they really talk of the attitude of feeling lucky, that has a lot to do with positive outlook. Because I do think, from a lot of evidence we have, that luck does play, circumstances does play an important role. But people who feel lucky tend to have a very positive outlook in the studies I've done of leadership. Hopeful, not stupid about, they're aware of the dangers too, but they tend to think of themselves as... But the thing about the hiring process at Zappos is this. I would think, Tony, that there's no way, even in the interview, where you would be able to predict how a person would respond to those core values without having them experience the company for 2 or 3 years. It would seem to me that, maybe that's too long a period of time, but it would seem to me that I would think, reading about your company, that you would want to bring people in who are young and who could develop and internalize those values over time. And with some, it just wouldn't work.
I guess we're less about trying to get people to adopt these values. It's more about just finding people whose personal values match the company's core values.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to always be thinking about it. I mean, it's just much easier. Like, every employee just automatically is living the brand. I guess the way I think about it is, you know, there are companies out there that really focus on what they say, and then there's companies out there that focus on behavior, so what they do. And then for us, we think it's just much easier in the long run to just focus on who we are. If you're hiring people who are inherently, their personal values are the Zappos core values, then you don't need to focus on telling them how to behave, because it just is a natural byproduct, and you don't need to come up with all these policies and procedures. And, you know, which also works for some companies like Disney and Ritz-Carlton, for example. They dictate certain behaviors. You have to walk a customer to the elevator, for example, or when you point, make sure to use your hand or two fingers, but not a single finger. And, you know, you can come up with that as a way of creating a great customer experience as well. But I think the challenge with that is it's hard to predict every possible scenario that might occur. So our philosophy is really make sure everyone understands the vision for Zappos. And for us, it's about making customers happy, delivering the very best customer service and customer experience, and then focus on culture and hiring employees whose personal values match our core values. And most of the rest of the stuff just takes care of itself. And you don't really need to talk about what scripts to use on the phone or come out with... there's a lot of corporations out there trying to figure out what their social media policies should be. And, you know, ours is just be real and use your best judgment. And mm-hmm. you know, we trust our employees.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you have, let's do just two more. You got one for me and I got one more for you.
Tell me about... in your life, the one of the most disappointing moments for you, what you learned from that experience?
You ask good questions.
I steal them from Dave Logan.
Yeah. Dave Logan steals them from me. Where is he? No, as a matter of fact, I've actually wanted to teach a course with somebody I want a partner to teach with. What makes a good question? I mean, that's a question that facilitates, the question that has resonance. To ask that good question is, for me, so important. And that's why I thought this exchange of questions would be good. But I keep forgetting the questions you asked me this then.
Tell me about one of the most disappointing moments in your life?
I was going to say real estate, but that's too glib. First of all, the reason why it's a marvelous question is because I have to think, because I tend not to regret things that are disappointments, but to just say, what the hell did I learn from it? The first thing that came to my mind, though, was first couple of years I was president of university, and I feel I made one big, big mistake, huge. And it was becoming president of the University of Cincinnati back in the 70s. It was a university that really, in some basic ways, needed to change. When I say basic ways, it was going to go broke unless it became a fully state-supported university, which it now is. And I came in from the East as an outsider, from Harvard, MIT, that kind of a... I didn't take the time to really understand the city, its proudness. The difficulty is it was a city university, but only 6% of the revenue for the university was coming from the city. So it was partly a myth. It took us 3 years of my work there to become, to finally when I got into knowing and learning more. And I realized that one of the toughest things for a change agent, as I was brought in to be, is how do you both celebrate and adhere to the symbols of the past and yet invent a new culture, and to walk, navigate it without seeming disrespectful to 100 years of previous history where you're starting something new. And I felt I never took the time, though I was warned. I was said, look, this is a very proud city, but it's very conservative. In fact, Mark Twain, who I quoted earlier, said the most marvelous thing about Cincinnati, about its conservative ways. He once said, if the world ever comes to an end, I want to be in Cincinnati, because it will happen there 10 years later. So, but I did not realize, Tony, that it is disrespectful to think you're going to change a culture without really taking the time to deeply understand that culture in which the foundation was laid before you can reinvent. Carly Fiorina is a good example of that. It's what I call contextual intelligence. People talk a lot about social emotional intelligence, very, very important. Equally important is from the old musical, The Music Man. You gotta know the territory. And Carly Fiorina is a good example. A woman who, when she was appointed to CEO of HP, I was rooting for her. She was the first woman, she was the first non-engineer, and most importantly, she was the first non-HP person ever to be appointed CEO. And I kept being continually disappointed when I would meet with HP executives and they would tell me how she never got the engineering culture. She got seduced by the publicity, by being the poster girl, by being at the Davos conferences and, what I call the elephant bumping conferences where the big shots get together. And it's easy as a younger executive with overnight success to get seduced. And in her case, she never learned the culture. And I think my biggest disappointment, my first couple of years at Cincinnati, was people told me, just take your time to get to know the community, the faculty, your students. Don't get into the press. It's a very kind of Scandinavian culture. No poppy should be taller than the other, And I listened to it. I mean, I heard it, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. Take it in. And I was looking back on that period, my first 2 years there, I really felt, boy, that's something I'm never going to... That notion of contextual intelligence, and I see smart leaders failing all the time. One of the biggest reasons I think I've seen some CEOs, top leaders, fail is not understanding the territory. and that the situation. Senator John Kerry, a perfectly smart, able man, no matter what one's politics,